Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024. I'm your reader, Denise. On the front page of the Gazette, Waypoint plans new Housing First facility. Organization looks to convert closed Cedar Rapids shelter into affordable housing, by Marissa Payne, the Gazette. Waypoint Services is looking to convert its now-closed emergency shelter in downtown Cedar Rapids into a Housing First facility by adding affordable rental units with community services in an effort to move toward ending homelessness. As service providers nationwide move more toward Housing First approaches to keep people in stable housing, Waypoint on January 1st closed its year-round emergency shelter, the Madge Phillips Center, at 318 5th Street Southeast, a shelter for women and children. Housing First models provide stable housing for those experiencing chronic homelessness and then addresses behavioral, mental health, or substance use issues. The approach recognizes that for people to address employment barriers or substance abuse issues, individuals first need basic necessities such as a place to live. Waypoint's Housing Services Director, Janae Peterman, said the building needed several costly repairs, including its HVAC system, elevator, plumbing, and a roof. Making those repairs would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars and likely require more fundraising. In the last 5 years, Peterman said the shelter census had decreased by approximately half, while the use of preventive services increased more than sixfold. In fiscal 2019, the shelter served 260 people, while homeless diversion eviction programs, which support those in risk of homelessness but who are not yet unhoused, served 412 people. By fiscal 2023, the budget year that ended June 30, 2023, shelter use fell to 138 and prevention services served 2,983 people. Still, Peterman said the emergency shelter program was the most expensive program Waypoint ran, always operating at a deficit and relying on community donations. It costs about $500,000 a year to operate. While shelters have a place in the homeless services response system, Peterman said, they do not end homelessness. With demand falling for those services, she said it's a good time to make this transition to focus more on prevention and housing stability to truly end homelessness for people. Before the shelter's doors closed, Peterman said the last family renaming there was an asylum-seeking family who Waypoint helped find housing. The family moved into that housing December 23rd, so no families were immediately affected by the shelter's closure. It felt to us that that was a lot of money to put toward continuing this Band-Aid where we could be focusing our efforts and our energy somewhere else and with more towards a solution, Peterman said. We decided it was best to make the shift to not continue pumping money into something that's not a solution to ending homelessness. Washington, D.C.-based National Alliance to End Homelessness studies show Housing First models make families more likely to remain housed and are a better solution than shelters. The organization, which the City of Cedar Rapids enlisted last year to aid in improving local homelessness systems, reported Housing First programs could save up to $23,000 a year per consumer versus shelters. In Iowa, Iowa City-based Shelter House has led the charge for Housing First facilities and has opened two, most recently at 501 Southgate Avenue in 2022 and at Cross Park Place in 2019. This permanent supportive housing assists chronically homeless people who need intensive case management. Plan still in works. Peterman said it's likely the upper level of the facility will be turned into 6 to 8 affordable apartments serving the population that uses Waypoint's housing services. Typically, this population earns up to 30% of the area median income. There would be supportive services on site, including case management. Leasing the apartments would be based on the coordinated entry system that local housing providers use to support those experiencing homelessness. This community-wide list is what providers use to fill their program vacancies so people aren't falling through the cracks and ensures people get a fair chance at available programs. Waypoint reported 13,790 people were served through that system in fiscal 2023. To fill the building's first level, Peterman said Waypoint officials are talking with another nonprofit to potentially collaborate, or the space could be turned into more residential units. Whatever goes in that space will be part of our mission of ending homelessness and moving people forward, Peterman said. A timeline for the building's rehabilitation isn't firm yet. Peterman said Waypoint still is exploring what's possible in the whole space and will have to secure funding. It'll continue to be operated by Waypoint, but Peterman said that there may be community partnerships with this space to make sure that we're providing services holistically to the community. Waypoint Chief Executive Officer Jay Kennedy last week told the downtown self-supported municipal improvement district that local nonprofit Matthew 25 was exploring a grocery store on the lower level, but no decision has been made yet. Matthew 25 has had very preliminary conversations with Waypoint about the possibility of a grocery store in their space near Green Square. Clint Tweet Ball, Matthew 25's executive director and founder, said in a statement, "While we always want to be part of the conversations to eliminate more food deserts in Cedar Rapids, it's too early to determine whether a grocery store is a viable option for this space." Renters may need to show need for service animals. A bill allowing landlords to request documentation is headed to the governor by Tom Barton, Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Landlords could require tenants to provide documentation if they needed an assistance animal under legislation headed to the Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds for her signature. Senate File 2268 changes how landlords respond to requests from individuals with a disability who request to keep an assistance animal or service animal as a reasonable accommodation in housing. Instead of immediately waiving charges and lease restrictions on pets, landlords could evaluate requests and must respond promptly. The bill also lists when landlords could deny requests, such as for a financial burden or safety concerns. It unanimously passed the Iowa Senate on Monday after being amended by the Iowa House. The bill was amended to provide written proof of disability and the need for an assistance animal from out-of-state health care providers, in addition to in-state providers. It also eliminates the term service animal in some areas of the bill because the term still falls under federal definition of assistance animals. Senator Scott Webster, the bill's floor manager and Republican from Bettendorf, said the legislation will help tremendously to make sure those in need of assistance animals can get them while preventing inappropriate use. Under the bill, if a person's disability or disability-related need for an assistance animal is not readily apparent, a landlord can request a letter from licensed healthcare professional verifying the individual has a disability and the necessity of the animal for the tenant's well-being. However, tenants are not required to disclose their disability. Rather, they need only disclose enough information to document their disability-related need for an assistance animal. Landlords also could request certification of the patient-provider relationship and whether the provider received a separate or additional fee or other form of compensation solely in exchange for making the written finding of their disability-related need for an assistance animal. The bill defines assistance animal as an animal that qualifies as a reasonable accommodation under the Federal Fair Housing Act. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development defines an assistance animal as one that provides assistance or performs tasks for the benefit of a person with a disability, or that provides emotional support that alleviates one or more identified effects of a person's disability. Service animal means a dog or miniature horse, as set forth in regulations under the Americans with Disabilities Act, that is trained to perform tasks on behalf of the individual due to the disability. Landlords still would be required to make reasonable accommodations for assistance and service animals in their rules, policies, practices, and services normally required for pets. The bill states it shall not be construed to restrict existing federal law related to a person's right to a reasonable accommodation and equal access to housing, including but not limited to the Federal Fair Housing Act. Under the bill, landlords could deny a request for an accommodation for an assistance animal or service animal if, number one, doing so would impose an undue financial and administrative hardship on the landlord. Two, it would fundamentally alter the nature of the landlord's operations. Three, it would pose a direct threat to the safety or health of others that cannot be reduced or eliminated by a reasonable accommodation. Four, it would cause substantial physical damage to the property of others that cannot be reduced or eliminated by a reasonable accommodation. And finally, is not otherwise reasonable. A tenant with assistance or service animal would be liable for any damage done by the animal to the leased premises, the landlord's property, or any other property. Landlords may also require proof of compliance with state and local licensing and vaccination requirements for each assistance or service animal. They would be required to provide a written determination regarding a person's request for an assistance animal. The Iowa Developmental Disabilities Council and Disability Rights Iowa were registered against the bill. Representative Josh Turek, Democrat, Council Bluffs, is a Paralympian, a two-time gold medalist in wheelchair basketball, and disability advocate. Turek said the bill attempts to clarify the distinction between an emotional support animal and a trained service animal. We want to avoid any unintentional consequences of disability animals that really need the service animal, Turek said on the House floor. We want to have more regulation on the emotional support animals without adding any unnecessary burden to the disabled individuals, or eroding any of those protections. Representative Jacob Bossman, Republican, Sioux City, who floor managed the bill in the House, said it is modeled after California law and federal Fair Housing Act. I believe it establishes clear, common-sense regulations that are transparent and will protect good-acting tenants and landlords and make this system sustainable well into the future, Bossman said during the floor debate. Representative Heather Mattson, an Ankeny Democrat who served on the subcommittee that advanced the bill, said while the bill does not address all of her concerns related to documentation requirements for assistance animals, I do think that this amended bill is a great example of bipartisan compromise that clarifies a framework and provides a clearer structure for landlords to follow that remains in compliance with the federal law. And finally, on the front page, bill stokes anxiety in Iowa's migrant communities. Questions linger about proposal that gives state power to deport. By Hannah Fingerhut, Associated Press, Des Moines. A bill in Iowa that would allow the state to arrest and deport some migrants is stoking anxiety among immigrant communities, leaving some to wonder, should I leave Iowa? The legislation, which is expected to be signed by Governor Kim Reynolds, would make it a state crime for a person to be in Iowa if previously denied admission to or removed from the United States. It mirrors part of a Texas law currently blocked in court. Across Iowa, Latino and immigrant community groups are organizing informational meetings and materials to try to answer people's questions. They're also asking local and county law enforcement agencies for official statements as well as face-to-face meetings. As 80 people gathered in a Des Moines Public Library community room last week, community organizer Fiobola Schirmeister pulled written questions out of a tin can. In Spanish, one asked, is it safe to call the police? Another asked, can Iowa police ask me about my immigration status? And what happens if I'm racially profiled? Erica Johnson, executive director of Iowa Migrant Movement for Justice, the organization hosting the meeting, sighed when one person asked, should I leave Iowa? Entiendo el sentido, she said. I understand the sentiment. Schirmeister, who hosts a local Spanish language radio show, explained how long organizers have worked to build a bridge with Iowa law enforcement. It's sad how it's going to hurt the trust between local enforcement, pro-immigration organizations, and the immigrant community, she said. Des Moines Police Chief Dana Wingert told the Associated Press in an email that immigration status does not factor into the department's work to keep the community safe, and he said it would be disingenuous and contradictory to incorporate it in the same time law enforcement has been working to eliminate such bias. I'm not interested, nor are we equipped, funded, or staffed to take additional responsibilities that historically have never been the function of local law enforcement, he added. Legal challenges. In Iowa and across the country, Republican leaders have rallied around the refrain that every state is a border state, as they accuse President Joe Biden of neglecting his responsibilities to enforce federal immigration law. That's led Republican governors, including Reynolds, to send troops to support Texas Governor Greg Abbott's Operation Lone Star and legislatures to propose a variety of state-level strategies. Iowa's lawmakers advanced the measure to address what one lawmaker called a clear and present danger posed to Iowans by some migrants crossing the southern border. Republican Representative Steve Holt acknowledged questions of constitutionality around the bill, but ultimately argued that Iowa has the right, the duty, and moral obligation to act to protect our citizens and our sovereignty. If we end up in a court battle with the federal government, should this pass, bring it on, Holt said during the subcommittee meeting in February. I think it's time for every state to stand up and say, we've had enough. We will defend our people. The Texas law is stalled in court after a challenge from U.S. Department of Justice, which says it conflicts with the federal government's immigration authority. The department did not immediately comment on the Iowa bill. The Iowa legislation, like the Texas law, could mean criminal charges for people who have outstanding deportation orders or who have previously been removed from or denied admission to the United States. Once in custody, migrants could either agree to a judge's order to leave the U.S. or be prosecuted. The judge's order must identify the transportation method for leaving the U.S. and a law enforcement officer or Iowa agency to monitor migrants' departures. Those who don't leave could face rearrest under more serious charges. Questions remain. The bill in Iowa faces the same questions of implementation and enforcement as the Texas law, since deportation is a complicated, expensive, and often dangerous federal process, said immigration law expert Hyun Pham of Texas A&M School of Law. How are Iowa law enforcement agencies going to determine if someone has entered Iowa in violation of an immigration order? Pham asked. She said questions remain about which country a detained person would be sent back to, how they would get there, and how agencies would communicate with those countries. Deportations are a binational process, she said, meaning the federal government negotiates with the governments of other countries. Disjointed immigration policy, state by state, could threaten those international relationships, she said. Mexico has already said that it would reject any state or local government enforcement of immigration laws. The Iowa State Patrol, as well as representatives of multiple state police departments and county sheriff's offices across the state, declined to comment on the bill before it signed into law. Sean Ireland, president of the Iowa State Sheriffs and Deputies Association and a deputy sheriff in Linn County, said in an email that law enforcement officials would consult with county attorneys for guidance if the bill becomes law. But Ireland added that community police relations are a priority and law enforcement's focus is not on looking for people who came into this country illegally and are not committing crimes. Don't be afraid. Manny Galvez, leader of Escucha Mi Voice, Hear My Voice community group based in West Liberty, said the bill has galvanized immigrant communities, including some that are in hard-to-reach areas of Iowa, to send the message that immigration is a human issue and the state's meatpacking plants, cornfields, and construction projects rely on immigrant labor. Lawmakers advancing the bill like this one are disconnected from that reality, Galvin said. Criminalizing the immigrant community is not the answer, he said. We tell people, do not be afraid. No tengo miedo. We are going to keep fighting this. On the Iowa Today page, North Liberty Police Chief on paid leave pending investigation. Officers' unions voted no confidence in her ability to lead force, by Emily Anderson, The Gazette. The North Liberty Police Chief has been put on paid leave while the city investigates grievances expressed last week in a public letter from the North Liberty Officers Union and Sergeants Union. The letter, released Friday, listed a number of grievances including poor communication, ambiguous time-off policies, and not hiring or retaining enough officers. The two unions had met together a few days earlier on March 24th and unanimously voted no confidence in Chief Diane Veninga's ability to lead the department. The unions notified the city about their vote, but did not provide an explanation until the release of the letter, according to Nick Burgess, the city's community relations director. The City of North Liberty takes employee concerns seriously while simultaneously making no presumption on their merit. Accountability is important for maintaining community trust and a disciplined police force, Burgess said in an email. The police chief reports to the city administrator, Ryan Heyer, who made the decision to put Veninga on leave. Veninga's current annual salary is $147,430.44. The city is working on arranging an independent investigation of the claims in the letter, but doesn't have a timeline yet. Burgess said an organization has been selected to perform the investigation, but the city still is running conflict of interest checks and will release the name of the organization once the details are finalized. Police Lieutenant Tyson Landsgaard will be handling the daily operations of the department while Veninga is on leave. This is not expected to impact service levels of the department to the community, Burgess said. The police, North Liberty Police Department now has 26 officers and sergeants. Academy for Scholastic and Personal Success turns 35. Tickets on sale for gala to support education of Black biracial students by Grace King, The Gazette, Cedar Rapids. The Academy for Scholastic and Personal Success this month is celebrating 35 years of empowering Black and biracial kids in Cedar Rapids. Attendees will experience the culture of New Orleans at the Academy's gala from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. April 18th at the Hotel at Kirkwood Center, 7725 Kirkwood Boulevard, Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Tickets may be purchased online at theacademysps.com. The gala will be a really joyful learning experience about the contributions, trials, and triumphs of Black Americans in Louisiana, said Ruth White, founder of the Academy. The Academy provides high school students an education they can't find in a public school classroom. It teaches students about Black history, literature, math, science, and holds a post-secondary seminar to help students prepare for college and be successful once they get there. White was a teacher at Washington High School and academic advisor to minority students when she founded the Academy 35 years ago. The work she did with those students showed her that a lot of students of color weren't making a connection that if they did well in high school, they would go on to college and a career of their choosing. White said the need for the program today is more urgent than it ever has been. She said she continues to see lower expectations for Black students and academically and a lack of encouragement. White has seen students at the Academy gain the confidence they need to dream bigger and map out a plan for how to achieve those dreams. At the end of a rigorous 6-week summer program, students have the opportunity to travel and learn more about Black history outside Iowa. There also are programs for adult learners and after-school programs for elementary and middle school students in Cedar Rapids schools through the Academy. The gala's New Orleans theme was inspired by Academy students' trips to Louisiana last summer. While in New Orleans, students toured Le Musée de FPC, a historical house museum dedicated to the legacy of free people of color, and the New Orleans Museum of Art. Food served at the gala is inspired by the food of the famous Dookie Chase's restaurant in New Orleans, which opened in 1941 and became a meeting place for music and entertainment, civil rights, and culture. The gala is the Academy's largest fundraising event of the year, making up about half the annual budget. Students in the program also pay tuition. Alana Brathwaite, president of the Academy's board, said she believes investment in the organization will make Cedar Rapids better by creating citizens who care about the community. Brathwaite, an information technology engineer, also was a student of the Academy. It helped me feel a level of confidence in myself I didn't know I was missing at the time, Brathwaite said. Ahmed Elsheikh, 18, a senior at Kennedy High School, is the youngest of his siblings to graduate from the Academy. It's an opportunity for Black students that shouldn't be overlooked, he said. Throughout his 4 years of high school, Elsheikh said he was pushed and championed by his teachers and peers at the Academy. At the gala, he will be speaking about the importance of the Academy and how vital it is for Black community in Cedar Rapids, Elsheikh said. Wilsey Coley, who graduated from Kennedy High in 2022, also was a student of the Academy. She said it helped her become a leader and advocate, especially for Black youth and for mental health. Sraja Servin, who graduated from Washington High School in 2021, said the Academy helped her create a plan for life beyond high school. Now she's a first-generation college student at the University of Iowa. Oftentimes, I'm the only Black person I see throughout the day. The Academy taught me to seek out community and understand what it means to be a Black person in the world, she said. Programs for kids, adults of all ages. The Academy for Scholastic and Personal Success also offers a free learning opportunity for adults called Critical Conversations. It's a place for people to learn about Black history, ask questions, and have discussions with experts in a safe environment. Past topics include redlining, reparations, Black cooking, the history of Black music, Black athletes, Black representation in film, critical race theory, and the 1619 Project. The current series, How Did We Get Here, ends April 8th. It meets virtually and in person at the Beams Auditorium at the Cedar Rapids Public Library, 450 Fifth Avenue Southeast. The final session of the series addresses diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Black middle school students also learn more about their culture and improve their academics at the African American Awareness Program for 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. The program is an after-school program students can opt into at Cedar Rapids Middle Schools. To participate, students are required to have an equivalent of a 2.5 grade point average, good attendance, and good behavior. Elementary school students in grades 3, 4, and 5 can learn more about their culture and gain academic and leadership skills in the Academy Expansion Program after school Mondays at Johnson Steam Academy, 355 18th Street Southeast, Cedar Rapids. To learn more or register for these programs, visit theacademysps.com/what-we-do. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Charles Russell Immerman, 62, of Iowa City, died at home on March 29, 2024, of end-stage renal disease. A small private family celebration of life is planned for a future day. Sandra Klemp, 81, of Iowa City, died Sunday, March 31, 2024, at the University of Iowa Medical Center downtown. An informal gathering will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. on Friday, April 5, 2024, at Lenzing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. Barbara Ann Wiley of West Branch, 80, passed away peacefully on March 29, 2024, at the University of Iowa Healthcare Center downtown. Per Ann's request, she has been cremated and there will be no formal services at this time. Instead, her family invites you to celebrate her life by sharing a memory or photo of Ann on her tribute wall at www.lensingfuneral.com. Ruth Vera Hess, 90, of Marion, Iowa, passed formerly of Anamosa, Iowa, passed away on Saturday, March 30, 2024, at St. Luke's Transitional Care Center in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. A visitation will be held from 12 to 1:30 p.m. on Friday, April 5, 2024, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. A graveside service will follow at 2 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Donald Dean Donahue Holbrook was born September 14, 1962, in Sigourney, Iowa. Dean died on Saturday, March 30, 2024, at Rem, Iowa, in Hiawatha, of 61 years of age. Funeral Mass will be held 10:30 a.m. at St. Mary's Catholic Church, Williamsburg. Burial will be at the St. Michael Cemetery, Holbrook. Visitation will be held on Thursday from 4 to 7 p.m. with a rosary service at 4 p.m. at the Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg. A general memorial fund has been established. Messages and tributes may be left at www.powellfuneralhomes.com. Donna K. Flugopt Brower, Summerfield, Florida, 74, formerly of Central City, died Friday, March 29, 2024, at Summerfield, Florida, of cancer. Celebration of life will be held at a later date. She will be missed by all those who loved her. Stacy Marie Kinney, 37, Iowa City, died peacefully Saturday, March 30, 2024, at home surrounded by her family. Visitation will be Friday, April 5, 2024, from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. at St. Mary Parish Hall in Oxford. A prayer service will be held at 7 p.m. Family committal will be at Mount Calvary Cemetery. S. K. Orr of Marion, Iowa, passed away on March 28, 2024, at the age of 80. A private graveside service will take place in Garrison, Iowa. Ardeth E. Davis of Marengo died on Saturday, March 30, 2024, at Rose Haven Nursing Home in Marengo, Iowa, at the age of 84. Funeral Mass will be held 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, April 4, 2024, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Williamsburg. Burial will follow in St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery, Williamsburg. Visitation will be held on Wednesday from 5 to 7 p.m. with a rosary service at 4:30 p.m. at the Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg. Charles Lee Davis, 87, of Shelbsburg, Iowa, passed away on Friday, March 29, 2024, at the Hemp Hill Hospice Unit at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids due to Alzheimer's disease. Services will be held at Murdoch Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids on Tuesday, April 30th at 11 a.m. with a visitation time with the family starting at 10 a.m. All are invited to the fellowship time and lunch after the service. Further Iowa news, NBC's Harry Smith returns to Central College to teach. Retiring TV journalist to teach curiosity classes this fall in Pella, by Brooklyn Drazy, Iowa Capital Dispatch. NBC News last week said goodbye to Harry Smith as the veteran journalist prepares to teach college students about curiosity at his alma mater, Central College in Pella. A 1973 alumnus, Smith earned his BA in Communications and Theater from Central College, according to NBC News. He announced after his last NBC Nightly News broadcast Thursday that he would return to Pella to teach at Central College this fall as an executive in residence. "And I might write a book or two, we'll see," Smith said Friday on Today. Called one of TV's most distinguished journalists by NBC, Smith has served as an NBC correspondent since 2011 when he joined Rock Center with Brian Williams. He got his start more than 30 years ago on radio stations in Denver and Cincinnati before shifting to television journalism with the Denver CBS affiliate KMGH-TV. Smith became a CBS news reporter in 1986 and a correspondent in 1987 and hosted CBS This Morning and The Early Show, as well as serving on CBS Evening News, Face the Nation, and CBS News Sunday Morning as a substitute anchor. I've had this unbelievable array of phenomenal experiences since coming to NBC, Smith said on Today, and so I'm really full of nothing but gratitude. Massive fish kill in Iowa draws a paltry fine. A recent fertilizer spill at New NEW Cooperative in southwest Iowa that entered the East Nishnabotna River killed approximately 750,000 fish over a 60-mile stretch of river. According to reporting from the Iowa Capital Dispatch, it is the largest fish kill in Iowa in a decade and the fifth largest in our state's history. This story should be national news, but maybe you haven't even heard about it from your local news outlet because it's on the other side of the state or because spills that enter a river or waterway seem to happen almost every other day here in Iowa. According to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources Fish Kill Database, There has been 64 fish kills in the past decade due to fertilizer, manure, pesticides, or other chemicals. Of the 58 events with fish kill estimates, over 1.1 million fish were killed. But this one fish kill in the East Nishnabotna is unique. The size of the fish kill is near the magnitude of all fish kills over the past decade combined. The damage is almost nuclear. Nothing living in the river for 60 miles, not to mention the bugs, worms, turtles, birds, snakes, and other wildlife on the shoreline or in the soil that rely on the river for food and water. The fact that this can even happen is incomprehensible. How can we allow fertilizer to be stored in a way that one single leak or open valve could result in the annihilation of an entire river ecosystem for 60 miles, the total death of a large river's entire population of not just fish, but mussels, frogs, snakes, and other aquatic life? It should not be allowed, and there should be penalties commensurate with the damage. The Iowa Capital Dispatch reported that the estimated value of the small fish is $85,000 and the value of the catfish is $115,000. What about the value of the river as a habitat for the future? What about the cumulative damage these kinds of incidents and industrial agriculture as a system do to Iowa's environment, wildlife, and overall livability? And what about the risk to humans that live near this river who would be drinking contaminated well water or exposed in other ways? So far, the DNR has fined New Co-op $6,000 for this massive spill. DNR fines are capped at $10,000 unless the department pursues further restitution through the courts. Will the department pursue more? Will residents, landowners, and lawmakers register the scope of this incident and demand accountability from the company responsible for this annihilation, or will they let it go and let New Co-op continue business as usual? In many ways, the values of our waterways and natural places cannot be estimated or given a dollar value. Many of the services our environment provides can be measured in dollars. Ecologic and economic studies are building models to calculate what are known as ecosystem services, such as resistance to natural disasters, pollination of food crops, etc. But there is inherent value in our natural places that we don't need scientific modeling to know exists. I know many Iowans like myself feel, without needing to see the numbers, that our environment is critically damaged and getting worse, and it doesn't seem as if anyone with the power to make change is paying attention or calling for a different path. It feels more and more like we have lost the natural integrity of our state and are truly a sacrifice state for industrial agriculture. Our state leaders seem to prefer it that way. My job as an advocate for Iowa's waters often requires me to build enthusiasm and provide optimism that invites others to join the fight for Iowa's environment and contact their elected officials about these issues. But incidents like these leave me feeling heartbreak and despair. All I can say is that this is wrong. We all know it, and we must, and we will continue to call it out and demand better. Alicia Vasto is Water Program Associate Director for the Iowa Environmental Council. Guest column, Alicia Vasto. Guest column, Sherry O'Brien, What I Learned Living with Wind Energy. The best way to learn is from experience or from someone who has had experience. Here are some things I learned about renewable energy from hosting a wind project on my land. The easement payment for having a wind turbine, transmission lines, and an access road to my land was about the same amount as the yearly payment for our combine. This income is guaranteed every year, no matter what weather or markets do, and it helps keep farming operations in the black. According to the American Clean Power Association website, Iowa farmers and landowners received $73.4 million in lease payments for 2023. That's helping a lot of farmers keep their operations in the black. I've also learned that some Iowans have been swayed to not support renewable energy. It's sad to see considerable portions of the state taking away these opportunities from consenting landowners because of loud anti-wind groups. Misinformation has led to opposition of our natural resources, wind and sun. With excessive restrictions and moratoriums, some fellow Iowans are missing out on an opportunity for guaranteed income that can help keep generational farms afloat. Let's not forget the massive tax revenue our counties would be missing out on, including funding for public schools, revitalization projects, and emergency service in small towns and rural areas. Iowa County was fortunate. We had county leaders who developed an ordinance that allowed landowners to voluntarily host projects on their property while including appropriate setbacks and protections for those landowners who chose not to host. I am no longer an owner of any land with wind easement, so I no longer benefit financially from it. I have 10 turbines about a mile or so from my home. The closest is a half mile away. All of them are on the neighbor's land, and I support their right to host turbines on their property near me. It would be more efficient and beneficial to communities if siting requirements for renewable energy were consistent statewide rather than vary so much from county to county. I encourage our state leaders to expand access to renewable energy in Iowa and leave the decision-making to the landowners. Sherry O'Brien lives in Victor. In the community letters, Linmar budget woes due, in part, to policies. While I hate to see anyone get laid off, I think Linmar policies have contributed to this problem. The loss of students in a growing district doesn't make sense under normal conditions. I am aware of numerous families moving to alternate school options, including private schools, homeschooling, and out-of-town sites such as Springville, Alburnett, and Center Point. If the Linmar board would suddenly become less woke, they would see their enrollment start to grow again. Harry Brown of Marion. Reynolds' policies cast a cloud over Iowa. This grandma cannot hold back concerns any longer about Iowa's education system. I watch as the headlines continue to speak of school administrators' struggles with loss of state funding. We see where some are destined to make cutbacks in resources to make their budgets work. Others have been forced to close. I remember the days when graduates would leave the state of Iowa to pursue work elsewhere, but would return once they had children. They spoke of coming back to Iowa because the education system was known as one of the best. Now things have made a complete change. Governor Kim Reynolds has taken measures to provide families funding if they attend private schools. I thought our governor was elected to represent education for all children, public and private. While making these budget cuts, she boasts of her large budget surplus. What's wrong with this picture? A dark cloud covers our state. Remember this in November. Janice Carson, Marion. Ex-middle school assistant coach sentenced to 17 years for child porn. Former CCA track assistant pretended to be a teen girl online by Trish Mahaffey, The Gazette. A former middle school boys assistant track coach in the Clear Creek Amana Community School District was sentenced last week to 17 years in federal prison for receiving child pornography. Corey Lester Schlemmy, 48, of Oxford, pleaded last year in U.S. District Court to one count of receiving child pornography. Another count of possession of child pornography was dismissed as part of a plea agreement. According to court documents, he received and possessed numerous images of child pornography, including sending himself images of children as young as 7 to 9 years old, from about December 19, 2019 through March 22, 2021. He also created multiple Facebook accounts where he pretended to be a teenage girl and communicated with a 15-year-old girl for over 9 months, encouraging her to produce child pornography and send that to him. The plea included examples of the sexually explicit and graphic requests Schlemmy made to the teen. Schlemmy admitted to viewing child pornography for 3 to 4 years before he was arrested, according to court documents. This conduct is aggravated by the fact that he put himself in a position to have access to children through his employment as a coach for Clear Creek Amana Schools. Coaching children is the same age range as the child pornography he was receiving, viewing, and soliciting, Assistant U.S. Attorney Andrea Glasgow said in her sentencing document. There is nothing in the record, though, that shows any of the victims were students at the school. Schlemmy was employed as an assistant coach from April 1, 2019 until August 19, 2021, when he was terminated. His district salary was $2,410 in 2021. Last Wednesday, U.S. District Judge Stephanie Rose sentenced Schlemmy to 17 years in prison and ordered him to serve 5 years of supervised release following his term. He will also be required to adhere to the requirements of the sex offender registry. Schlemmy was ordered to pay $5,000 to the Justice for Victims of Trafficking Act, which is a federal special assessment or fine. Cedar Rapids police respond to swatting call at Jefferson by Emily Anderson, The Gazette, Cedar Rapids. Police responded Monday to a swatting call at Jefferson High School, the second such call at the school in 2 months. The call came in at 12:57 p.m., and emergency crews began clearing out about 1:20 p.m., according to the Cedar Rapids Police Department. Neither the Cedar Rapids Community School District nor the police department had released additional information about the nature of the call or the response. Cedar Rapids police also responded to an unfounded threat February 2nd at the school, 1243 20th Street Southwest, and the school locked down while police swept the premises. Swatting calls are hoax reports made with the intention of creating a large police presence at the scene. The Iowa House and Iowa Senate both have unanimously passed a bill, Senate File 2161, that increases the penalties for certain swatting hoaxes, but it has not yet signed the bill into law. It tore her apart when Denova Walker's friend saw her bleeding. Walker was killed with an 8-inch butcher knife by Trish Mahaffey, The Gazette, Cedar Rapids. A woman who considered Denova Walker her goddaughter said it tore her apart when she went outside and saw Walker lying on the ground, bleeding, and then saw her eyes rolled back in her head. Sheila Thomas, who lived next door to Walker on January 2, 2023, testified Walker had been with her that day and over the holiday weekend, and they'd been having a fun time making videos, doing Walker's hair, and cooking chicken. Thomas was keeping Walker's children, babies as she called them, and also had her 3-year-old grandson. Thomas didn't know what happened outside the apartment. She didn't know Walker had been stabbed by Shane Teslick, who is on trial for voluntary manslaughter. Another neighbor came to her door saying Walker was on the ground and had been hit or fell. Thomas did know about a previous incident between Walker and Teslick that happened December 19, 2022, which other witnesses testified about last week during his trial in Linn County. Thomas said Teslick told Walker to shut up and called her a racial. According to testimony, an argument on January 2, 2023 escalated and Teslick, 38, threatened to kill Walker, 29, and called her that name, same racial epithet, that he had also allegedly called her on December 19, 2022. On January 2nd, Walker ran at Teslick, knocking over his girlfriend, Jesse Chavez, before she punched him twice, and then he stabbed her once in the left side of the chest outside his apartment at the Cambridge Townhouses, 2135 Town, North Town Court, Northeast. Teslick also is charged with disorderly conduct, epithets, threatening gestures, a simple misdemeanor. The prosecution should wrap up its case today, and the defense will start. Walker's friend describes 2022 fight. Thomas testified that on December 19, 2022, she was with Walker and another person outside her apartment when Chavez came up and told Walker to shut up. Teslick told her the same thing and called Walker the epithet. Thomas said Walker turned to her and asked if he called her that slur, and Thomas agreed and said, "Yeah, we're all black here." Thomas told Walker to ignore him and call the police. Thomas went back to her apartment, but she said when Walker came back to her place, she was so angry, she tried to calm Walker down and told her to not pay any attention to Teslick. On cross, Thomas said she didn't know Walker had used any drugs. She knew Walker had been drinking alcohol. In previous testimony last week, the autopsy showed Walker had methamphetamine, cocaine, and marijuana in her system on January 2nd. Thomas also said she didn't know of Walker to be armed, carrying a bat or pipe. Neighbor shot video because she thought it would be fun. Stephanie Hill, also a neighbor of Walker's, said she had heard a disturbance outside January 2nd, 2023, and decided to take a video of it on her cell phone because Walker, Chavez, and Teslick had engaged in arguments in the past. She said initially she decided to take a video because she thought it would be funny. Hill said she didn't know what was going to happen. The argument started escalating as Walker was on the sidewalk in front of Teslick's and Chavez's apartment, Hill said. Hill testified that Teslick repeatedly told Chavez to come inside, but she wouldn't. Teslick told Walker to leave. Hill said she then saw Teslick open the door. He called Walker the epithet, and that's when Walker screamed and ran toward his door. Walker made contact with Chavez, who fell over, and Walker tripped over her and went for Teslick in his doorway, Hill said. Walker punched Teslick, and he made an uppercut motion. Hill said she didn't know Teslick had a knife and stabbed Walker. Walker went back toward the sidewalk, stumbled around, and then collapsed in the front yard. Hill said Chavez was walking around saying Walker was faking it. Hill told police when they arrived that she did this, but she testified that she meant they did this, Chavez and Teslick. Hill said she thinks Walker was dead before police or emergency medical personnel started CPR. In other testimony, Craig Krueger, Cedar Rapids police crime scene investigator, testified about the knife used in the stabbing that was found in Teslick's apartment. The butcher knife, which was about had an 8-inch blade, was found on the countertop next to the sink, Krueger testified. It had blood on the blade, covering more than 5 inches of the blade. Last Friday, a state medical examiner testified the depth of the horizontal stab wound was 9 centimeters, and the injury went from left to right and front to back as it entered the body. Dr. Jonathan Thompson, deputy state medical examiner and also a forensic pathologist, testified the stab wound was one of the deeper ones I've seen. The knife penetrated Walker's left lung and aorta, which resulted in her bleeding. On sports day areas, interesting events today, girls track, Marion, Jefferson, Kennedy, Washington, Linmar, Xavier at Kingston Stadium, 4:15 p.m. Prairie, Regina, Iowa City West at the Williamsburg Invitational at 4 p.m. Boys track, Marion, Kennedy, City High at Western Dubuque Invitational, 4:15 p.m. Prairie, Xavier, Regina at Williamsburg Invitational, 4 p.m. Girls soccer, Prairie at City High, 4:15 p.m. Liberty at Linmar, 5:45 p.m. Waterloo West at Jefferson, 4:15 p.m. Boys soccer, Jefferson at Waterloo West, 4:15 p.m. Girls tennis, Waterloo West at Liberty, 4 p.m. Washington at Dubuque Senior, 4 p.m. Xavier at Cedar Falls, 4 p.m. Jefferson at Dubuque Hempstead, 4 p.m. Iowa City West at Western Dubuque, 4 p.m. City High at Dubuque Wallert, 4 p.m. Boys tennis, Cedar Falls at Xavier, 4 p.m. Dubuque Hempstead at Jefferson, 4 p.m. Dubuque Senior at Washington, 4 p.m. Western Dubuque at Iowa City West, 4 p.m. Dubuque Wallert at City High, 4 p.m. Liberty at Waterloo West, 4 p.m. Girls golf, Prairie, Dubuque Senior at Washington, Gardner Golf Course, 3:15 p.m. Kennedy, Liberty, Western Dubuque at Linmar, Hunter's Ridge Golf Course, 3:15 p.m. Xavier, Dubuque, Wallert, Waterloo West at City High, Pleasant Valley Golf Course at 3 p.m. Jefferson, Cedar Falls, Dubuque Hempstead at Iowa City West, Finkbine Golf Course at 3:15 p.m. In college baseball, Eureka at Cornell, 4 p.m. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. For Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024, I'm your reader, Denise. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.